Good morning and welcome to Back Chat. I'm Brian Curtis.
And I'm Sarah Passmore. Today we're talking about whether the MPF is an effective retirement scheme.
The policy is intended to make people save for their retirement, but legislators are concerned that it's not sufficient to cover the increasing demands of the aging population here.
Analysts say much of what is put in is eaten up by administrative fees, and investors will only end up with a lump sum at the end of the day.
Welfare groups are suggesting promoting a universal retirement protection scheme, and they're warning taxpayers may have to bear a 10% rise in profit tax if a scheme isn't implemented soon.
So do you think we should be given a choice in managing our own finances?
And how much do you think you'll need to live on when you retire?
We'd like you to call us with your questions and comments on 233-88266, or you can email backchat at rthk.org.hk. Well, we're joined this morning by David Webb, the editor of website.com, Eric Lee, senior partner from Lee Tang Chen & Co., Professor Stephen Chung from the Department of Economics and Finance at City University, and also on the line from Singapore, we're joined by Michael Asher, who is a professor at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy at the National University of Singapore. David Webb, I'd like to start with you first. You have very strong views on the MPF. Tell us what they are.
Well, I think in summary that the MPF should be scrapped. It's an interference in private choice. It assumes that people are not capable of saving for their own retirements. I think they're well incentivized to save. When you look at the standard of living that people suffer if they haven't saved for their retirement or were unable to, the basic social safety net which any government should provide in Hong Kong relatively low. You may even end up pushing cardboard boxes around the streets to supplement your income. So the incentives for most people, I think, are fairly clear. But the way in which the MPF is imposed on people and the way it's structured results in very high expense ratios and restricts their freedom of choice to invest or save as much or as little as they wish.
Is it completely useless, though? I mean,
it fails in a number of respects. I think the legislative intent probably was to try to shift some of the burden of the social safety net to individuals and make them, those that might not otherwise save, compel them to save. That's why it's called mandatory. But the problem is that it pays out a lump sum when you're 65. So if you're the kind of person who perhaps gambles a lot or finds it difficult to actually sequester any of their money on a monthly basis, then when you get your lump sum, you're just as likely as you ever were to go around to Happy Valley and squander it all in one night.
I have a little bit of a problem with that contention, David. If you say that people are responsible enough to save on their own, but then you say if they get a lump sum, they're likely to go out and blow it on a few wild nights at Happy Valley. Aren't those conflicting thoughts?
Yeah. No, I'm saying that the vast majority of people are capable of managing their own finances and saving as much as they wish for retirement in order to live at a standard that they wish to live at.
Well, if they are capable, then why would they blow it in Happy Valley?
The intent of the scheme was only really to protect those small minority who are not capable of saving that money by forcing them to. And I'm saying that if that was the intent and brings everybody else into the net at the same time, then even then the intent has failed, because for that small minority, when they get their lump sum, they won't be helped to save it and draw it down gradually. If anything, there should be an obligation, as there is in some societies, to put the money into annuities or to only withdraw the money at a certain rate when you do hit retirement, so that you can live off that.
Okay, so you basically have two problems with it. One is the technical way that it's being, the efficiency in the way that it's being handled, and also whether or not the choice should be taken away from Hong Kong people. Let's work on that second one for a moment and see whether it really is necessary. We have an economist or a professor of economics with us, Professor Stephen Chung. What do you think for that small minority of people who aren't capable of saving for the future? Do we need a scheme?
I think there's a common belief that we need a three pillar systems for the future retirement system. The first one is mentioned by David, the Social Security Net. The second one is personal saving. And the third one is a pension scheme that right now, the one we have, the MPF scheme in Hong Kong. I think when David mentioned about well, there's a low expenditure on the social safety net. Maybe only two for right now, because in 20 years' time, when we project our population growth, we're talking about one in four people who will be aged more than 65. For the year 2030, people like me have reached my retirement age. So we're talking about a quarter of our population will reach that age. So there will be increasing demand for social welfare, increasing demand for medical care and pension related expenditures as well. So I think there is a need for such a pension system. But I do agree with David that we need a more efficient one. Meaning that when we compare with the existing fund scheme, apparently that there is a big portion of our return spent on expenditure or administration related costs, you know, in this kind of pension fund. I mean, that poses a question: is could we have a better MPF scheme? That's all.
Yeah, I just want to point out, perfectly true that the demographic is shifting in Hong Kong, that the proportion of elderly people will increase. It doesn't follow that the proportion of people relying on Social Security will increase, because people are more prosperous now, their real incomes are higher now than they've ever been in the last 50 years. The people who are retiring today are people who probably didn't have any money to save when they were working in the factories of Hong Kong, in plastics and in textiles and so on, in the 50s and 60s. So it doesn't follow that one quarter of the population is going to be dependent on Social Security. In fact, I think the proportion will go down and down because people will have put away more money on their own for their own retirements. The social safety net is intended to be there simply to provide social stability so that people don't resort to crime or other methods to support themselves when they run out of money.
Do you think most people are realistic about their retirement and how much money they need to save, whether or not it's within the MPF or another way of saving?
I think there's a lot that could be done to improve their awareness of this through education, starting in school, basically. I think there's an insufficient amount of economic education in school so that people can understand.
When you're at school, you don't think about your retirement,
right,
do you?
Right, but all the way through and on a continuing basis, the government needs to do a bit more to explain to people how much they need to save in order to be confident of a comfortable retirement. And another thing we must all bear in mind is that as medical science improves, I think the governments around the world will raise the retirement age. There's currently talk in some countries of raising it by 1 year for every 5 years in the next 20 years so that it'll go up by 4 years or possibly 5 years to 70. As medical science improves, it should be possible for people to work, if not full-time, at least part-time, for longer. And that in itself will reduce the whole pensions issue.
If the MPF isn't scrapped, because it looks like we're stuck with it, and the savings then stays compulsory as it is now, how would you suggest reforming it, giving people more choice?
One important thing is at the moment that the choice of MPF provider is not made by the employee. The choice of provider is made by the employer. The only way you can change providers if you're an employee is to change jobs, which is rather like saying if you don't like the music on your radio, then buy a new radio. What we need is to give people personal choice, take it away from the employer who has no interest in the future returns because they don't receive them, and instead give people personal provident funds. They choose their own provider, they maintain that relationship if they move jobs, they keep the fund with the same providers unless they choose to choose a better performing provider. I think that would increase competition, which would reduce the very high fees and charges that people are currently suffering on their funds, and on a compound basis, those fees can really eat into your returns. For example, over 40 years, if you're paying 2% per year, 55% of your capital and returns will go in expenses, and only 45% will be your lump sum at the end.
Let's bring in Eric Lee. Eric, why is it that these custodial and trustee and management fees are so high? Why couldn't they simply track an index and limit the cost?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons for this. If we track back the origin of the Monetary Provident Fund, I think that's a product that's been under discussion for over 30 years, actually, before it became law. We've been in search for a perfect system for a long, long time. I think, to be fair, the pressure of the Provident Fund originally comes from labor, unions, the union people. Actually, they're not just forcing the people to save, they're forcing the employer to chip in as well to pay for the retirement of the employees. So, I think that we have lots of argument and debates publicly and in the Legislative Council, and eventually we settle on this fund. Now, but to be good employers, I think it adds a lot of complexity. I think the union people will not settle for law unless it is highly transferable, that there are various options offered, and making the administration of the fund quite expensive. Now, normally, it is not a big issue for a big employer with a big fund. But if it's going to be catered for a lot of small enterprises, self-employed people, to make it compulsory to include everybody, and a small portion of it is in a central problem fund to look after these people, the cost of that will increase quite dramatically. I think it's partly because of the nature of it being a mandatory provident fund for everybody, and partly because it's got to be so portable. At the end of the day, I think the administration fees became quite high. It's the complexity of it. I think if we really look at the reform, I think we should be looking at who should be excluded, and maybe we can make the administration of all these a lot simpler.
Is it true what David says about the employer only selecting? Because I think in some cases, doesn't the employer put a basket of possible funds together?
Absolutely.
And the employee can't make a choice.
The fund provider, the person who manages that money, is chosen by the employer. Now, the provider may offer us a set of in-house funds to choose from, but they'll all charge roughly the same fees on each fund.
I think in principle, David is right. I think that's the, at the end of the day, somebody is going to make that decision. It's the employer, because the employer put in half the fund as well, and sometimes even more in the bigger employer. But many good employer, particularly a large one which got a sizable fund, would offer a wider range of funds for the employee to choose. And some of them were even, particularly like universities and sacred bodies, would set up trustees and allow somebody more independent to actually make the choice for them. And many of the good employers, when they run funds like this, would do it in consultation with the employee and employee representatives. So although the decision by law is made by the employer, but in practice, many of them do run a sort of consultative approach. But at the end of the day, if you look at it from the banking side, the fund manager side, there are fairly intense competition, even now.
Why isn't that driving down the administration cost then?
As I say, I think the complexity of the fund is very costly. Employer can jump ship, move funds all over the place, and they can, in many of the funds, they can also choose from one fund to the other without penalty. They can switch fund from fund, and all these adds up. People do change their mind from time to time, and all these adds up to a lot of costs in running it.
Let's bring in Dr. Asher, who is an expert on the Central Provident Fund that is what is operated by Singapore. Dr. Asher, is Singapore's model better than Hong Kong's?
Singapore model is different. When we consider better, we need some criteria. One of the criteria is what is the real rate of return which the members get from their balances with the provident fund. When we examine Hong Kong and Singapore, in Singapore, the real return to members has been only 1.2% per year for the 1987 to 2004 period. When I look at the annual report of the MPFA, I find that for 2001 to 2005, the real rate of return was 5.68%. So on the real return criteria, MPF is doing quite well.
Why is there such a difference?
Well, this is a fairly complicated arrangement in Singapore, where the return that is paid to members is not what the investment returns are, but is administratively determined as the weighted average of the one-year fixed deposit and the savings account.
What happens to the other money then?
Well, what happens is that the Central Provident Fund has buys only non-marketable government securities from, and government has a budget surplus, so that money is turned over to Singapore Government Investment Corporation and others who by statutory provisions do not need to reveal what their investments, their performance, and so on are.
Does most of that go into property?
We don't know the full portfolio of the Singapore Government Investment Corporation, and they invest around the world. So basically, it becomes an implicit tax on the members, and that is why the rate of return is very low.
And we should say that, it must cause a lot of concern for people because quite a lot of money is taken out of their paycheck. Isn't it something like 20% in some cases?
No, it is 33%. But we have a wage ceiling. So it's not quite comparable to the 10% in Hong Kong because there is no wage ceiling, as I understand.
Yeah, there is. It's $20,000.
$20,000. Mm. Okay. We have 5,000 Singapore as our wage ceiling. The second criteria you can judge is whether replacement rate, that is the annuity income divided by the pre-retirement income that the people may expect to get, which will account for both longevity risk and the inflation risk. So we have to calculate it in real terms. Now, for Singapore, it is likely to be in the teens. So Singapore is going to have a low rate of replacement because of the very high withdrawals, pre-retirement withdrawals, for property. In Hong Kong case, the design is much simpler because you don't allow any withdrawals, but I haven't seen any calculations as to what might be the replacement rate, so I cannot compare directly.
Mr. Webb has done extensive research on this. Do you know what the replacement rate is?
Off the top of my head, I don't, but it will be very low because of that. First of all, there's a cap of 20,000 on which the MPF is calculated, so nobody puts away more than $2,000 per month. And secondly, because it is only 10%, that won't be enough for people to live in the style that they've been living on their employment income, and they do need to add to that if they want to be close to their existing standard of living.
But if I may add here,
yes.
Respond to that. World Bank has recently come out with their position paper, which talks about 5-year system instead of a 3-pillar that they had earlier. And the 5 years include the social assistance and some of the non-financial assets, housing, gold, and others, and families and community support. Now, what is important is that in any social security system, we don't try to get the full replacement rate, which experts tell us around 66 to 75%. We don't try to get that from one scheme, but we try to have a multiple schemes or multi-tiers, all 5 tiers, that will tend to reduce the risk of one pillar going wrong. So I wouldn't be too worried if MPF or CPF by themselves do not provide enough. But what I would worry about is there a other type of tiers that are also introduced, and that together whether they provide enough retirement security.
Stephen Chung?
Well, going back to the previous discussions, I think I agree that we need more pillars. I mean, say, for example, Hong Kong is talking about the medical insurance scheme now. Mm. I think that should be classified in one of the tiers we're talking about. And for David's reform, I think the further reform of the pension system in Hong Kong, I think we need a more transparent systems of the pension fund. I mean, the operation of pension funds themselves, you know. We are talking about how much we pay the fund managers, you know, what is the exact return, the risk, because we have to consider the risk and return trade-off as well of this fund investment. And also mentioning about the switching cost, how often that employees, they can switch from one one fund to the other funds, and what will be the cost of doing that. I'm sitting on the university pension scheme. I'm one of the trustees, and I would push for this kind of a structure. And it's very interesting because as investors, as a fund manager, when they are investor, they push for more listed company transparency. They want to know how much a listed company paid the directors. They want them, or what they want, this pension compensation scheme listed in the annual report. And right now, coming to their own transparency structure, the fund manager, how much we pay them as a fund manager to manage our investment. Can we know how much we pay them? As a contributors, I mean, to this investment fund. So I think a more transparent system should work. I mean, should be in place, and then we can have a better choice and better comparison with from fund A to fund B to make a better choice.
Do you think that will happen? Do you think the government will make changes?
Well, there is a code that was produced by the Mandatory Provident Fund Schemes Authority earlier this year, which will require disclosure of expense ratios on fund statements and fund fact sheets, basically starting next year. So people will be aware of how much is going in expenses on their funds, but that doesn't give them the choice of changing fund providers. If their employer has always run its payroll through HSBC, for example, and simply chose HSBC out of convenience, then they'll be restricted still to the funds offered by HSBC. There isn't, short of changing jobs or mass protests in the staff, which I think are very unlikely, given the very long nature of the payback, there won't be much pressure still to change providers. So I still think that if we are to retain the MPF, flawed as it is, then it should be a personal provident fund where you choose your own provider and you maintain that relationship separate to your employment relationship. That, of course, will reduce some of the administrative overhead because you won't have to withdraw your money every time you change jobs and move to a new provider. So introducing that personal choice, I think, will then create the competition which is really lacking at the moment and drive down the expense ratios, given that they will be more publicly available to employees next year.
Eric Lee, the Central Policy Unit is apparently considering some changes. Do you have any heads up you can give us on possible reforms that might be coming to the MPF?
I have absolutely no idea what they're contemplating. But as David said, I think transparency do encourage more competition. I hope that that's the way they're going to go. But my own experience as trustees of university funds and other mandatory provident fund is that employees tends to look at the performance of the manager in real terms rather than just looking at expense. I think that we're more likely to look at the ranking, look at the track record rather than the expense that they pay. But still, to keep the control the expense on a very transparent level, I think is essential.
I would just say one thing. Past performance is not necessarily a guide to future performance, as they will always tell you. But past fees are a guide to future fees because they tend not to go down very much.
that needs education again.
Okay, well, we're talking about the MPF this morning, whether or not it's an effective retirement scheme, how you'd like to see it changed, if that's possible. We'd like to hear your views. 233-88266 is the number to call, or you can email backchat@rthk.org.hk. We're making a break for the news for 5 minutes, so do get your calls in now. We've got lots of experts here who could maybe answer some of your queries. Leaving you with the weather first, though. It's going to be mainly fine today. A few isolated showers, though. The maximum temperature today is going to be about 32 degrees, and there's going to be some moderate southwesterly winds. The API at general stations is low to medium. At roadside stations, medium to high.
You're listening to Backchat on Radio 3. Call us on 233-88266 or email backchat@rthk.org.hk. It's your voice.
Welcome back to Backchat with me, Sarah Passmore, and Brian Curtis. This morning we're talking about the MPF, whether or not it's an effective retirement scheme, and we're joined by David Webb, the editor of website.com, Eric Lee, a senior partner with Lee, Tang, Chen & Co., Professor Stephen Cheung from the Department of Economics and Finance at City University, and Michael Asher, Professor at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy at the National University of Singapore. We would like to hear from you too, though. And Thomas has emailed us. He said, the government obliges us to contribute to the MPF. I, as most residents, am restricted to a small number of MPF providers. Effectively, I'm directed by law to gamble with no guarantee of any percentage of return, either on the return or even on the basic sum deposited. What kind of ridiculous situation is this? It disgusts me. That's from Thomas.
And Mike has called to say that this was the last colonial act by the British to squeeze as much out of the Hong Kong people as possible. It hasn't done anything for the Hong Kong people. It's just another form of taxation. But the British firms, he says, continue to reap the benefits. I'm not so sure about that. But David Webb, you're not so happy with the MPF, but not exactly for this reason.
Well, the comment isn't that inaccurate, actually, because HSBC Group is widely believed to have about 50% market share, and that is a UK head office and domicile company. So to say that the British got a lot of the action, I think, is not an unreasonable comment.
But HSBC is a Hong Kong company, too.
It has Hong Kong subsidiaries, certainly. About a third of the group business is in Hong Kong still. Standard Chartered is another big player. They're also UK incorporated. I don't think this is a nationalistic issue, though. I don't really care where the providers come from. I think everyone's welcome to provide these services in Hong Kong, wherever their head office is. The point is that it shouldn't be mandatory on the public to put money with them. You know, we should provide people with their own choice. Hong Kong's always believed in small government, so we're told, and big markets and freedom of choice. And this goes against that grain by telling people to put away 10% of their incomes.
Yeah, would there be a way of doing a fund like this or a scheme like this with an opt-out for people?
Well, it already exists. Without the MPF, people are perfectly welcome to walk into any bank branch and say, I wish to start a long-term savings plan. Or talk to a financial advisor and decide how to save their money. So I mean, a voluntary scheme is what the free market is all about. There's no need to legislate on that. You know, I think that's the way it should be. And let's not forget that although it's only 10% of gross income, a lot of people do have fixed outgoings. They have, you know, transport and housing, mortgages or rentals to pay every month. Giving them back 10% of their gross income might make as much as a, say, 30% difference to their disposable income. It would give them a lot more choice on how they live their lives.
My point is, now that we have this scheme, would there be a way to legislate to allow people to opt out if they wanted to?
Well, that would mean scrapping the mandatory part of it,
right,
and making it entirely optional. That's what I advocate. There's no reason why people could not remain in these schemes on a voluntary basis. I don't think everyone would necessarily withdraw their money on day one because they might not have a plan of what to do with it. But when we move in that direction and scrap the mandatory, then people will have the choice. If they wish to withdraw their accumulated assets and invest them somewhere else, they can. And one of the big things about Hong Kong is that we've never penalized savings by taxing capital gains or dividends. So there is no tax break, really, for having money in the funds, other than the deduction you get when you make the contribution.
Do you think, I mean, it's quite early days still for the MPF. It's only 5.5 years old. Is there plenty of time in the future to make sort of adjustments and, you know, maybe it won't seem so harsh in your mind in the future?
Well, yeah, if you have a flawed policy, you should correct it as soon as possible, as soon as the recognition dawns on the policymakers that something's wrong with the scheme.
But you don't feel there's any indication that's going to happen?
Well, I think a lot of issues like this, which are really about freedom of choice for the public and pro-consumer issues, depend on democracy. Because if you have democratic reforms, then I think that a party which advocates scrapping the MPF and giving people their money back to choose how they save it would have better electoral prospects than one which didn't. I think a lot of these big reforms, and in my sphere, class action rights for minority shareholders and so on, will have to wait until we get democracy.
Okay, we've got a caller on the line. Simon, good morning.
Good morning, yes. I'd like to say, basically agree with David Webb that the mandatory provident fund should be turned into the voluntary provident fund, and there's absolutely no room for other kinds of reform within it. There's a lot of public hostility to the MPF. We had a public consultation in 1992, and the MPS then was roundly condemned and shelved. It was then rammed down our throats in 2000 without any further consultation at all. And the reason I think a lot of people oppose this plan is simply because, you know, we are individual human beings with free choice.
But Simon, you don't have free choice in the tax rate set by the financial secretary, do you? Would you rather see the government raise your taxes?
No, I think that you know, the taxes should be kept as low as possible. And, you know, certainly you have free choice to a certain extent as to whether you pay tax or not. You know, if you you can choose a low tax jurisdiction in which to do business in. But I mean, the mandatory provident fund is basically, you know, morally offensive because it takes away our personal choice and deprives us of our right to think in our way, our right to make our own decisions.
But is morally offensive the right word? I mean, is being created to help people so that when they're old, they don't. You know, well, I mean, have nothing to live on.
I mean, it's morally offensive because, you know, you've got this nanny state saying that, well, they think they know better than everyone else and they want to take away personal choice from people to make their own decisions. And, you know, people have a right to their own life. They have a right to make decisions as to how they live that life. And suddenly you've got a government saying, no, you can't make those decisions. We're going to impose those particular decisions on you.
But we don't live independently. We live in a community, and this is the community deciding how we should live together.
Well, two things. First of all, it's not the community deciding because there's overall hostility to the MPF. Secondly, each person is a sovereign individual. We are all individuals within society, and as such, we all have a right to our own life.
But okay, if you don't like the MPF, how do you make sure that everyone has some kind of financial backing in their retirement when they're elderly?
You don't. You leave it to them.
So if people don't sort it out, they rot on the street. That's fine.
Well, no. I mean, what you're doing is this is a slippery slope argument. What are you going to do next? Are you going to start up fat camps for obese people and send anyone over a certain weight to these camps to make sure that they only eat government-approved food? You know, it's the government's interference in the private lives of people, and that's what makes it offensive.
Well, if you're talking about health, the government does interfere. It does tell us not to smoke. It does have warning.
But it doesn't force people to give up smoking. People still have that right. It doesn't force people to stop going to McDonald's. What it's doing in this particular case is bringing in force and stopping people from thinking. Now, the thing is, the MPF can be abolished, and we should work towards that. Let's send a message to the government that bad policy can be removed, that it can be changed. And, you know, especially before special interest groups get their hooks into the MPF and start trying to take 50% of all contributions into a general welfare fund. You know, that's the slippery slope that we're going on.
Here's some facts for you, okay, and I'd like to get your response. The number of CSSA recipients has gone from 61,000 10 years ago to 150,000 now. The Social Welfare Department's estimated expenditure in the last year in CSSA was $17.3 billion. So I go back to the original question. The government says that part and parcel of this is if it doesn't do something like provide for people to provide for themselves, then they will have to raise taxes at some point. And you won't have much choice in that, will you?
Well, no, they don't have to raise taxes. Why do they have to raise taxes? I mean, the whole thing is, where is this money coming from? Who are they taxing? I mean, you have to remember that taxation is legalized theft. So when you're stealing money from one particular family, that means that they don't have the decision to do what they want to do with their particular money. Now, instead of them giving money for social welfare to people they've never met before, maybe they would prefer to do something else with that money for themselves. Maybe they prefer to spend that money on extra education for their children. Maybe they want to, do an MBA or something like that. But what's happening is that money is being stolen from them to support someone else's lifestyle, and that's manifestly wrong.
But then the rich get richer because generally
What's wrong with the rich getting richer? I mean,
well, it's nothing wrong with the rich getting richer, but it's what happens to the people at the other end of the spectrum, isn't it? You don't care about the people at the other end of the spectrum.
I mean, the whole thing is what you're setting up is some sort of false dichotomy. You say you're putting one particular group against the other, and what you know just because one person is earning money, it doesn't mean that they should be forced to support someone else or should be told that they're not allowed to get richer because someone else is not as rich as them.
Okay, well, let's just put this argument to David Webb. What do you make of it?
It is important to have a social safety net. As a society, we don't want to have to live behind high walls where gangs roam the streets or petty crime. Because if you don't have social security of some basic level, and I stress basic, there must be a warning to anyone that if you choose to rely on that in your old age, you're not going to have very much to rely on. You won't be taking foreign holidays. But if you don't provide some level of support, then you end up with unstable society. However, the CSSA system in Hong Kong does need restructuring. For example, currently there's a non-means-tested allowance for anyone over 70, which some people call fruit money here. I think it's about $390 a month, which even Lee Ka-shing could claim if he wanted. There's no point in paying money to people who don't need it. You need to reserve these allowances for people who do. I'm a strong believer in providing that basic level of social security because I like to be able to walk around Hong Kong comfortably at night on my own, and so does my wife.
Well, I mean, I disagree with David about the roving gangs, and basically the come down the point is, David, who are you going to steal the money from to pay for this? I mean, if you feel strongly about particular individuals not earning enough, I mean, you're certainly free amongst the market yourself to
Yeah, but not everyone is fortunate enough to be able to save. Not everybody has a job. A lot of people have to support their elderly parents or whatever. They're not working. They don't have an MPF. It's important that we still provide some living for them in their old age.
They can get that from places like the Community Chest, or there's private organizations.
No, I think that's an extremist point of view.
It's not an extremist point of view.
Well, you're advocating no government at all, aren't you?
No, I'm not advocating no government at all. I'm advocating a limited government that protects individual rights, and there are certain functions of government that are important, such as the police force, the court system, and those are the areas which the government gets involved. As soon as the government gets involved in other areas, it weakens the economy and it starts to inflict upon the individual rights of people.
Okay, Simon.
Eric Lee, what do you think of
this? Yes, I'm a former legislator, so I was very, very involved in the whole discussion for a long time. I think the demand from this scheme actually come from the unions, as I say, the employees' representatives. But it's Chris Patten who's got the courage to actually put it in consultation when it comes in 1992. Now, when the scheme was first consulted, they were criticizing the central provident fund, one fund for everybody. Not like now, it's a fund that you have a choice.
No, that's not true. Yeah, that's not true.
They've also consulted about some sort of mandatory provident fund, but Chris Patten come up with another scheme, which is an OH sort of scheme. You put in 3% each that will look after the immediate need of the elderly now. Now, that fund was thrown out, was severely criticized for one reason alone, is that because you're asking the present generation to look after the elderly now. But if you see the population projection, we are putting back that responsibility 10, 20 years later to our younger population. Now, although I subscribed for a voluntary provident fund earlier, I agreed to a mandatory provident fund because I don't want to leave the problem to the next generation. Because if you look at next generation, there'll be a lot greater proportion of elderly. And the social welfare figure shows that a great number of them are not quite capable of dealing with their own retirement.
That's the problem with Social Security in the U.S.
Yeah, exactly. It's always in any community that the responsible people have to look after the less fortunate and some of the less responsible people. The choice really, at the end of the day, is whether we are looking after the elderly now or let our younger population look after a much more difficult problem in 10, 20 years' time.
Okay, well, Simon, thank you for your call. We've had an email from Brett. He said, I lost my job over a year ago and it's not looking like I'll be working again anytime soon. Thankfully, my previous employment predated introduction of the MPF and I'm able to enjoy the funds now when I need it. If that money were in the MPF, then I'd be even worse off as my assets are too much to avail of public services I've paid for with my salaries tax for decades, but what happens when I can't afford to even rent a farmhouse in Kamtin? He said even $100 to go to a public hospital has become a big expenditure after decades of using only private health care outside of real emergencies. MPF was a good idea, but poorly implemented. As things increasingly are poorly implemented here, I'm afraid it's better to scrap it altogether. That comes from Brett in Canton.
Sonia has called to say she works for the judiciary part-time, but she says she doesn't benefit from the MPF because she's considered to be an independent agent. What does this mean, she asks, and why can't she get any benefits? Stephen Jung, lots of service providers are put in this category. Can you explain it to them?
Well, when you are a self-employed people, I think you can design your own pension scheme, your own MPF. And going back to the previous discussions, I won't urge the government to go so far, you know, to scrap the MPF. But my point of view is, once we have the system in place, what are the way to make our MPF more efficient and more cost effective, more friendly, usable to the employees. I think that this is the way to go.
But if you only looked at the past 2 years instead of, say, the last 4 years, the returns would be pretty handsome on the MPF, and people probably who have only been in it for 2 years think they've got a pretty good deal.
Well, I agree that our MPF provide better return than the Singaporean MPF, you know, mentioned by Asha. And also having a central provident fund, I think... that may give some temptation to the government to use our that big money
as they for some purpose.
So I think it's better to remain private, and also the way I see it, if we scrap the MPF fund, that will create some moral hazard problem in the future. That people know that if we don't, we do some bad saving decisions, the government have to take care of us at the end of the day. So I think it's a good deal. I mean, but it could make it better, the MPF scheme.
Sam has called in to say there must be a guaranteed minimum payment monthly for pension payouts for those over 65. That doesn't really work, does it?
Well, the question is who paid that?
Who is going to guarantee that?
How much money do we need to retire on? This is always the question that's sort of thrown about. Some people say you have to have $1.5 million in the bank for... Hong Kong dollars.
Well, it depends on how you want to live, you know. I understand that if we live elsewhere in a less expensive country, say for example right now when we look at China, if we want to immigrate there, if you want to have your retirement in China, in the far northwestern part of China, that won't cost you too much. If you want to live in Paris,
be nice.
You have to have more money.
But this is a scheme that the government is looking into, isn't it? Getting people to retire on the mainland, which would be cheaper.
Well, it's really a personal choice. I don't think the government could decide for us.
It would certainly reduce the demographic problem, wouldn't it?
They're talking about a plan, aren't they, where if you, as long as you resided in Hong Kong for 5 days out of the year, you could spend 360 in say, China. And still collect CSSA payments.
Well, at the current moment, I don't think we can do that. This is the way I understand. But I mean, given the options to these CCSA payment people, you know, to spend some of their time or to live in China, maybe it's a way out for both the government and also the recipient.
But it certainly reduces the burden on government of the CSSA if people are willing to live in the mainland, I think, because then they won't also need governmental health services. So the government saves some of the money it's paying in CSSA if it allows them to live overseas.
I think I better cut in because I was chairman of the Social Welfare Advisory Committee that made the decision and encouraged the government to do it. I think that was done on a pilot basis. I think we are extending certain area like Guangdong, the more popular places. But we do guarantee those people who do not live in Hong Kong to always come into Hong Kong. We give them back housing, medical benefit immediately. So I think there's nothing lost if they want to come back. I think that, but I think it does offer, I think the intention when I make that decision and urge government to do it is to give these people a choice.
Yeah.
I'll have to use that very, very limited fund.
The government, and is that popular? Is it a popular choice?
It's becoming a lot more popular. Than
Would it be so popular if people had more money? I mean, is it just a financial thing or do people want to go and live in China?
Well, I think for the same allowances, they can considerably live better. I think in China, the way we look at it first is that because if we look at the working life of an individual now who lives up to 80, 90 years old, they don't come out of school and get trained until they're in the early mid-20s. They work for maybe about 30 years of their life, or 30, maybe 35. Then they have to a very, very long retirement ahead of them. Now, if you look at them working for maybe 35 years and try to live a 30 years retirement, you have to save a great deal of money to cover the expenses, unless you can find some way to perhaps supplement it or live it in a more cost-effective way.
David Webb, do you welcome this, or do you think it's a cop-out on the government's behalf?
Not at all, because they're not forcing people to leave. They're giving them the choice and saying that if you do leave, you won't be penalised by withdrawing your CSSA allowance. I think as long as they have established their permanent residency in Hong Kong and being part of the society, then society owes them that level of basic support. And if they choose to take it while living overseas, that saves society the other costs that Eric mentioned, the housing and the healthcare and so on.
Dr. Asher is still on the line with us. Dr. Asher, what is the level of support from the average person in Singapore for the Central Provident Fund?
Well, it is very strong. One of the primary reasons has been that Central Provident Fund has acted essentially as a substitute for housing mortgage finance. And about 70% of any contribution dollars get withdrawn for housing, healthcare, pre-retirement investment, and other purposes. So because the housing has been so closely linked with the Provident Fund, and so is now increasingly healthcare, the support remains strong. I might also add that the recent behavioral finance literature has acquired a degree of prominence and influence also supports the mandatory nature, because it argues that people have temptation and are not able to control some of their behavior, particularly where it is a long-term financial behavior. And that in finance area, too much choice could actually be counterproductive as compared to limited choice. I know that goes against the general views that has been expressed by Mr. Webb, but I think that's what the research suggests.
I thought I noticed Singapore likes too much choice in anything, frankly, but I don't think Hong Kong should be heading down that track.
And I thought I'd noticed from your research that the number of employers was actually dropping. Is that true?
In Singapore?
Yeah.
Yes, it is. It is dropping.
Why?
There may be several reasons, including the fact that there has been a lot of consolidation in the economy. So it was 80,000 around. Now it's around 73,000. And what is important, though, is that the active membership is still increasing, though at a very, very moderate pace.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Professor Asher. That's Professor Asher from the National University of Singapore. We've also been speaking to Professor Stephen Chung from City University and Eric Lee from T. Tang Cheng & Co. and David Webb from website.com. We've been talking about the MPF this morning.
And if we got anything out of this program, it's probably that we would all like a little bit more choice and a lot higher returns.
The weather at the moment is 28 degrees Celsius with 84% relative humidity. It's going to be mainly fine today.